This is a song by the band Café Tacuba out of Mexico City. It's from the enduring 1994 album that's been called the White Album of Rock in Español. This song, Las Flores, is just one of the big hits from Café Tacuba, a band that's been together since the late 1980s. They've had an international following since the early 90s, and now there's this whole genre-bending world of experimental Latin rock that's kind of built up around them. But they were and are pioneers, and they've got a live show at the Uptown tonight. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with Enrique Chi and Andres Ramirez, two local musicians you may have heard of. Enrique is from Making Movies, and Andres is in a lot of bands. He just got back from a tour in Mexico with his band Reptil. For both musicians, Café Tacuba has been an influence. Andres, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
And Enrique, yeah, pretty good. Enrique, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you. I'm excited about this.
You guys going to the show tonight?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't miss it.
How would you describe Café Tacuba? Enrique, we'll start with you.
I would describe them, they're similar to me to the Beatles. In the White Album reference is really great. I've also heard people say they're the Radiohead of Latin America. They have this album called Cuatro Caminos that was called the Kid A, like the Radiohead of Latin rock, by American journalists. To me, they're like the Beatles, more so than Radiohead, in that they managed to they've stayed together as a family longer than the Beatles, actually, and they let each member shine in different moments. And
sort of how you can be like, this is totally a Paul song, or
totally. And and each member's songs have their merits, and you can kind of get lost in different worlds inside their world.
That makes sense, because as I've been listening, I have thought at times, this band sounds like different bands, like totally different bands sometimes.
Yep. And that's like the very, very Beatles-esque, where a song can go from Rocky Raccoon to, Sexy Sadie on the same album, and it's completely different planets it feels like they're on, but there's something unifying. And to me, they also musically are like a bit like a Flaming Lips experimentalism, psychedelic influence, but with a boldness to include folklore from Mexico, which in the 90s was very unhip to do. And so it was very punk rock to include folklore, because it was wrong in a rock and roll setting. Yeah.
Andres, tell me about your history with this band and how you would describe them.
Well, actually, Enrique did a great job describing it, and I absolutely agree that I refer to them as the Mexican Beatles. And some people don't like that because, the Beatles is something huge. But I think it's fair to say it. And if you follow this band as much as I have followed them since their first album, you can tell that it's like a parallel Beatle experience, because they go through phases. You follow the albums and you can see that they actually, even though they didn't break up, they separated and did their own jobs, because they're different. They're composers on their own. They cooperate with the band, but they also have their own projects. And then you see that they get together, they get back together, and then they have this kind of a redemption album. More like a, what are we doing? Why are we in? Or they were having a midlife crisis, and that's when they actually start getting way more involved in cultural issues and social issues. So I agree. Café Tacuba is a band that has been socially involved since the beginning.
Tell me more about that.
Well, but like Enrique said, in the 90s when they come out, rock and español didn't really have much of a platform, and it was considered rebellious music. In the 90s, it was more like a rebellion against the government, because now the lyrics of the music were actually saying things that were wrong in the society. it's not like in the 60s or 70s, it was just because they were wearing leather jackets. Mm-hmm. No, at this point, people, they were actually speaking out their minds, and that was that there was no way that the media was going to allow this to happen, because we were living in a, well, still in Mexico, in a very and corrupt and in a country where they don't let you speak your mind. I miss the word. Like,
well, I would. Yeah, that's the one thing I would add is, like, you know, and this is coming from the perspective of being an artist that does speak about social issues and experiences both sides of that, the like support because of it and the backlash because of it. That's a whole nother level to do that in Latin America. There's a whole nother level of bravery and courage that requires. And when I started listening to the Café Tacuba, I was a child. It was my dad liked them. And I actually got into the album that was a covers album. I can't remember the name of it right now. But it has like a skateboarder on the front of it. But that's the CD that my dad...
Avalancha de Éxitos.
Yeah. Avalancha de Éxitos, yeah. So that was my dad. My dad had bought that CD, and so I didn't grasp all of it at that time because I was a little kid. But it's funny how that's the music that has always stuck with me, is music that is dealing with very serious issues. And in hindsight, they always were.
Yeah, and Ruben Albarrán, which is the singer, the vocalist of the band, he's actually collaborating all the time with movements like Greenpeace. And actually, we had the opportunity to share stage with them in Mexico, not playing, but actually speaking our minds. You know,
oh, wow.
There was a movement when the Zapatista movement was going on.
Yeah,
we had like a big meeting in Mexico, in Guadalajara, and they were in town, so they actually came over to support. So that was good. You know, like, we weren't expecting them, and they came over, and that's normal. They do that all the time. They show up to show support on all the social issues. They always, when they go to a city, they always want to know what's going on here, you know?
Andres, you know, I want to play one of the songs by Café Tacuba that you sent to us, Aparato. It's a song that you say demonstrates the many Mexicos this band represents. We're going to listen in just a second, but can you tell me first what you mean by that?
Well, you know, especially for the Anglo people, when you say Mexico, you think mariachi, tequila, and guacamole, right? But there is many Mexicos. There is indigenous Mexico. There is the Mexico that is all into Justin Bieber. And there is a Mexico that is into very traditional music. So Café Tacuba is a band that for many years was not considered a rock band because they play songs like this, like this one. And it took a while for people to accept it, and actually made people be more like proud of their roots.
Well, this is Aparato by Café Tacuba, the legendary band from Mexico, performing at the Uptown Theater tonight.
Cuando volteé lo tenía arriba, es una luz. Algún tipo me dejó inmóvil, solo me quedó el zumbido de la luz. Lo escuchaba en mi cabeza, en lengua extraña me hablaba, pero entendí. Lo juro que no había tomado, solo estaba encandilado, la hora perdí.
Andres, when you hear this, what are some of the different sounds that you, like, really feel great hearing together there?
Well, maybe Enrique can add to this, but you can see that there is no electric guitar. There is not really a traditional drum set. So it's not like something like a rock band would play. This is Afro-Mexican instrumentation and style of music from Veracruz that they're performing. So... when they came out with this, that was music that only like old people would listen to. So the younger generations were not really into the Huasteco style of music. So.
Yeah, it's Huasteco, but you know, I think to an American ear, you're like, wow, that sounds foreign. But what they're actually really, and they made the Huasteco people upset too, I imagine, because they're also playing experimental chord movements that wouldn't be in Huasteco and using synthesizers on top of Huasteco. And it's like, what are you doing? That's wrong. So the Huasteco people are mad, and then rock and roll people are mad, and there lies Café Tacuba.
Well, and with many people having their own reasons to be mad, what is it that you love?
Well, there's people, you know, that's very extremist, you know, they want things the way they used to be, they don't want change. But actually, by Café Tacuba doing this, we have bands, because of that, we have bands now like Cafeteras, you know. We have bands that actually, because this band actually helped this music styles that were kind of dying come back, you know, and into the mainstream. So because of that, even the Huasteco music, the musicians that were upset, they are actually now taking advantage of that. And you see Huasteco bands come here. There was a band last year that performed here at the Nelson Atkins that they play very traditional Huasteco style.
There's been a revival. Like in L.A., there's like Jarocho, like a whole scene of people. Jarochos and Huasteco are kind of sister genres, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a whole scene of communities doing it. And I don't think that would happen if bands like Café Tacuba hadn't been bold enough to include that music.
Enrique, tell me a little bit about your journey as a musician and how this band's influence may have been a part of that.
Well, for me, they proved a point that I thought was, I had to take pride in. And if I look back at this point, I realize that there's a level of self-doubt or self-hatred or something. I don't know what the right word is. They proved to me that a band from Latin America can be as great as any band in the world. And the fact that that had to be proven shows that there's a cultural weight of like, yeah, there's music and then there's your music. And that never can compete. But when Café Tacuba was getting talked about in the same places, top 10 albums of the year, Spin, Rolling Stone, and it's next to anyone who made an album that year in the world. And it's like, this is one of the great rock and roll albums to exist. I thought, wow, somebody from Mexico can do that? I have a chance.
That's awesome.
And that was the light that they gave me. And that it's kind of screwed up that I had to feel that way. Yeah, but it actually is real. That's a real thing, right?
Of course it is. And yeah, I mean, the way you said it is correct. You know, like as a musician, we struggle a lot playing our music or getting a place to play. Making movies actually has opened doors here in Kansas City because of all the hard work that they have done. That it's been hard. I've been playing rock for a long time here, and it's been really hard to try to find a place where to perform. So having to prove ourselves has been part of the struggle.
I think I may have told this story on the air before, but you know, our ex-manager, which we learned a lot from them, from the time we spent with them, but part of the beginning
this
of
is
our...
your band making movies.
Yeah, the band making movies. Part of the beginning of our success is when we half lied. And we changed our bio, and we put nothing that was in Spanish in the bio. We said, there's a band called Making Movies, and at that time we had a catchy song called Pendulum Swing. So the band called Making Movies with a song called Pendulum Swing that has performed with Arcade Fire and Cold War Kids and is da-da-da-da-da, no Spanish. We eliminated half of the truth of our band to open doors.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Enrique, you have recommended one of Café Tacuba's more experimental albums, Cuatro Caminos. And I love that you recommended songs to us by track number because it reveals how much you listen to the album. You're
my gosh.
Play song five, please. So we're going to play song five. Okay. The song is called Camino y Verida. And I apologize for my accent. I cannot do the R. I am sorry.
That's okay.
Here it is. So I have to say, I This song, I really get the Radiohead comparison for sure.
Yeah, it's experimental, and I mean, even down to like the mixing, you know, they employed some world-class mixers like Dave Friedman, I think produced and mixed the record, but he definitely produced it, and he's worked a lot with Flaming Lips. And so that exploring sonic textures, I think this album sounds incredible too. It's just a beautiful sounding album from a recording technology standpoint.
With what we were talking about before, I mean, as I sort of like read up on this band, it seems like a big part of their importance really has been in opening up and broadening people's expectations of what Latin American music can or should be.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not the only band. You know, we have bands like Maná, which we refer as the Mexican police, the police. Mm-hmm. And we have like Caifanes, that is like the Mexican, the Cure. So bands like Café Tacuba had more struggle because they were not like any other, you know. I kind of got out of the question.
Well, you know, they're not as big as Maná as in Latin America. They're slightly smaller than them. But I think that I don't know if it was internal or them, but I've been in the game long enough to like be following whether a Making Movies track is getting played on stations like The Bridge, and there's like charts where you can see what songs are being added to those kind of stations around the country. And so I realized that a few years ago that Café Tacuba, they invest in marketing their music to American channels and have had some success in a way that I don't think Maná could, because Maná is so strictly Latin American, and Café Tacuba in their experimentalism and potentially their music also led to their strategy as a band, but I feel like it's maybe inside of them that they desire to find an audience in the United States, because they've worked the United States also harder, I think, than Maná and yeah. Caifanes and all those artists.
Yeah, for some reason, Maná don't like to come over here much.
Well, you know, we're going to have to go, but before we do, Andres, I want to talk about a song that you like because of what it's about. Esta Vez, and we're going to hear it in a second as we say goodbye, is a song of surrender or like redemption. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's on the album Sino. And like I say, I've been listening to this band since I was a teenager. And for somehow, I had grown and matured among the musicians. So when I listen to this song and I kind of feel what they were trying to express, I was feeling at the same time like that. So,
well,
yeah, that's what this
Andres
song
is. Ramirez, we're going to listen to Esta Vez as we go. Thank you so much for being here.
Okay, no, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Enrique Chi of Making Movies, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Kansas City, don't miss this show. This is world-class music that doesn't come around our way very often, so come out and support it.
We've been talking about Café Tacuba performing in Kansas City tonight. The show's at the Uptown at 8. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're going to hear about Renegade Cinema next on KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and now we're going to talk about The Stray Cat. It is a DIY movie house opening in the crossroads. They're going to show movies outside the mainstream, like Coming At Ya, the 80s Western they've got on the bill for tonight's grand opening. Here with the story is Jacqueline Danger, one of the people involved in the project. She's been showing oddball movies in oddball locations for a while now through a club that she's organized, and now she's here to talk about The Stray Cat, which kind of takes things to another level. Hi, Jacqueline.
Howdy, Gina. Thanks so much for having me today.
So this venue is called, it's what's called micro cinema. What is micro cinema?
So basically, it's a mini movie theater house. And so it's basically a 50-seat theater with the screen and kind of the most simplest form that you could make a cinema house to be.
What is the need that it's filling in your mind?
Well, we really had looked around at a lot of the local theater spaces in town. And there's quite a bit of a niche of communities that it's not actually serving, and a large basis of films that it's ending up not having the time to show because it basically is a commercial space and just doesn't have the time to show these one-off events. So we're basically being able to show a lot more independent art house films, locally made films, the traveling film festivals, filmmakers, and just a lot of movies that are usually not archived and put on to then the next generation.
Can you give an example of something that Kansas City may have missed because of this gap?
There's loads of traveling film festivals that go around the country every single year. And most of the times, Kansas City is such a small Midwestern town, it easily gets overlooked to St. Louis and easily over to Columbia with Ragtag. And so we're really kind of
filling... Yeah, because they have a theater that is a real destination in Columbia.
It does, and it brings in the true-false crowd, and it brings in a lot of different filmmakers who are willing to bring really unique stuff to the screen there. So we're really hoping to get that onto the screen in Kansas City to allow people to engage with cinema that you can't find on any of your streaming services that you'll just sit at home and get a chance to see.
There's, you know... I've heard that you guys don't actually have the aspiration to become commercial, which I'm understanding from what you've already said, but how do you know you're going to get to keep going? Because you have 1 year of rent-free space, right, from the Charlotte Street Foundation.
That's true, yes. We've been lucky enough to be able to be the recipient of the Charlotte Street Foundation's 2018-2019 residency pop-up space. And so this is really great to be able to kind of work out our kinks, be able to fail a little bit and take more chances than usually we'd be able to do. So we're actually then a nonprofit, non-commercial artist-run space, and it's all organized by volunteers. And so, you know, we're going to give it our best shot, and hopefully we're supported enough by our community that people like us and want to keep seeing us do what we do.
Why is it called the Stray Cat?
Well, we're the Stray Cat Film Center, and a lot of it is an ode to then the old Stray Cat Lounge in town, and then also...
Tell me about that space.
Well, it's an old DIY kind of punk bar back in the day, right before like the Power and Light and the reboom of downtown area. And then it's also homage to this old Japanese biker gang cinema, the Stray Cat Rock, which is a really cool, groovy, all-female biker gang film that if you've not seen, you should definitely check it out.
I will have to do that. You are screening tonight, as I mentioned, a movie called, what is it called again?
It's called Coming At Ya.
Coming At Ya, yeah.
Yep,
I knew there was a ya in it.
I know, yeah, with an exclamation point. It's a big, over-the-top 1980s Western feature in the magical beauty of 3D. So this is our big old grand opening tonight. So we invite everyone to come out and join us for First Friday pre-party at 7 p.m. And then we'll be kicking off our 9:30 p.m. screening of Coming At Ya, all with everyone getting the 3D glasses. And it's going to possibility it might get more into the level of being 4D. This is more like an amusement.
4D.
It's more of an amusement park ride. This is like a very lowbrow, over-the-top film with parts in 3D that you've never really wanted to be in 3D, like flying arrows, fists. There's even a really incredible 3D baby diaper changing scene.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It's so good. Moments like that are riddled in this film.
What made Coming At Ya, the movie that you were going to use to like introduce Kansas City to what it is you're all about? What makes this just the right choice?
Well, I really felt like this matched kind of like our attitude that we have the space coming forward with. So it's like we're weird, off the beaten path, like more about the experience of going to a film that you can interact with. And so we're hoping people can come out tonight and get to meet a community of folks that you've loved, but you've never gotten to know who they are.
So if you can imagine out there the listener who does not typically go to a movie because of the joy of interacting with it, as you say, or that doesn't follow sort of like niche cinema or oddball cinema or whatever you want to call it, but can you explain the particular joy of this kind of movie-going experience? Can you take us with you into it, what it's about?
Totally. So we've been operating the Psychotronic film series for the last 6 years, and we've been showing a lot of these very kind of almost lost films to the next generation. And so most of the time, a lot of our viewers have just been blown away by the new films that they've never gotten the chance to see. And so you're really taking a risk to come out and see this film that you won't ever get to see on Netflix or on television, Hulu, and all that jazz. So you can come out and really enjoy things that are being brought to the screen that might never get the chance. And that's just tonight. We've got then on Sunday a traveling filmmaker, the Margaret Royson, who's doing The Clicks Inside My Dream. That's all on a 16mm showcase. So we're busting out the old 16mm films show. Then we got the Psychotronic film series coming up later in the week. And then our big film festival we're bringing back to town on October 20th, where we'll be screening the Ice Slicer Halloween Spooktacular.
Tell me more about the Spooktacular real quick.
Oh my goodness. So it's with one of our other favorite theaters in town, The Strand. So it'll also be their 101-year anniversary that we'll be celebrating all in that one night. And so it's been pitched as one of the weirdest television shows. So this is a whole short film showcase of the weirdest horror films that you could ever imagine.
Weirdest that I could ever imagine?
It's pretty over the top with like puppets and like interdimensional beings, time traveling Sasquatches. It's kind of ridiculous and hilarious all at the same time.
What is your long-term goal for the Stray Cat?
Well, our long-term goal is we want as many people to come and do volunteer programming and get involved. We want people to become Cool Cat members, and that's why you become a sustaining member of the space, and you are able to then bring films that you're wanting, that you think should be brought to the screen. We're really wanting to engage different communities in town that are often just never being able to have space at local theaters, and especially traveling filmmakers, giving them a space to show off their new work that they have.
Jacqueline Danger, thanks so much for stopping by on what I am sure is a busy day for you.
That's going to be one hell of a ride. And if you want to check out more info, go to our website at StrayCatFilmCenter.com.
The Stray Cat Cinema's opening shindig starts at 7 tonight. The movie screening fun starts at 9:30. There's a story all about it on our website, kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now I'm here to talk about what I think is a really refreshing art show at the Kemper Museum. It's called Flawless, and it was curated by the museum's Teen Council. That is a group of local teenagers who want a say in what goes up on the museum's walls. The works of art they've chosen have to do with our society's sometimes limited understanding of who and what is beautiful, and also the flip side, what is a flaw and what's just you. The images on the walls show people of different races, different ages, different personal styles, all being their beautiful, imperfect selves, and I love it. So I'm going to start by talking with the teen who fought hard for one of the images on the wall, Anthony Moses III. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome to the show. Will you please describe for me the image that people see when they walk into this exhibit?
So as soon as you walk in, you see a very large painting. It's humongous. It's these giant lips, a very zoomed in close call of somebody's lips. It's a man, and it seems like he has on lipstick, and it goes against the stereotypes of men and their masculinity. And it's the first painting you see.
You can see a little stubble.
Yeah, you can. You see his mustache, and like, you know, it's a man's mouth, and you see that first as you walk into the exhibit, and you're like, what does this exhibit mean? What's it going towards?
So you felt really strongly that this image belonged in the show, and it, in spite of being the first thing you see, it was not actually selected in like a first round, but you came back and fought for it. Can you tell that story and talk about why it meant so much to you?
I think it was just the fact that we wanted a painting in, and we had like an idea in our minds as a Teen Arts Council. And I had missed a meeting when this decision was made to keep the painting out. And when I came back to a later meeting, the Teen Arts Council explained to me, hey, this painting didn't make it in that we all wanted. And I was like, what? We missed a painting? What happened? What did you guys do while I was gone? Why are we struggling? And we detoured the meeting and made it into like a meeting on getting this painting back in, because we knew that we all really wanted it. So we just—
why did you want it so much?
I really don't, like, it was just something that we all want. Like, we were just all had that same knowledge about the painting. We just all knew we wanted it. It was just
the intro to the show. Like, there's some, the written language next to this image that introduces the Flawless exhibit, but also kind of talks about this image a little bit, says that it is bold and weird, like the Teen Council. Can you talk to me about that phrasing? I was very excited to read about bold and weird.
So we are all bold in our own ways, and we all do things very differently. None of us are the same personalities whatsoever. So you could say we're all bold in that way, but then you could also see an outsider who's like, these teens are weird. What are they doing sitting down, choosing these paintings, coming up with ideas? How's all this stuff fit together? So that's how we're both bold and weird at the same time.
Why did you want to be on the teen council?
My art teacher chose me to be on the council because she said that over the year that she had me, she's seen so much growth and how much enthusiasm I had with art. And she's seen that I was a great advocate for it. And she was like, you'd be great for this new program that the Kemper's having.
Tell me about your relationship with art.
It has grown so much in these past 2 years. Growing up, I never really had an art class. So I was just doodling at home with my mom or whatever and just tiny paintings. And then I got to high school and actually had a foundations class and actually was thrown into the realm of art and all these different techniques and artists. And it was amazing. I had some value behind my art and I wasn't just doodling on a piece of scratch paper that I found at home.
That's so cool. I mean, do you feel like having a space in a major museum in town as someone in your age group, like that's an important thing, that the teen voice is an important voice and that art is a way that it can reach people?
Having a teen's voice is very important because everybody's been a teen, but you may not remember exactly how it was to be a teen. So with the Kemper trying to reach teens right now in 2018, that's very different from many, many years ago. So they need that help, essentially. How do we reach these teens and know that we're actively getting their attention on trying to get them to the museum? That's an amazing thing. So we have that responsibility of like advertising, how we're pushing out the advertising. How do we want to change up the advertising for a certain event? How do we want to do everything? We have so much responsibility with the Kemper.
So you wrote, all of the teens on the Teen Council got to write about specific pieces in the show that, mm-hmm. that really spoke to them. You wrote about a Nan Golden image. It depicts two men in makeup, one standing in a doorway wearing like a netted crop top and cutoff shorts. And then the other guy looks like he's rummaging through a bag or something. He's sitting on the floor in the background. And I have the feeling we're maybe backstage in a dressing room or something. Can you tell me what that image meant to you?
For me in photography, I love capturing the moment and the essence and what's going on. I don't like to pose people and tell them, hey, put your arm in this spot, move your head that way. So when we were choosing all the pieces for the exhibition, we got all the explanations behind the paintings. Jessica told me, hey, this picture was something that was caught in the moment. She's seen the moment and was like, don't move, you guys. We're going to take this photo. And she took it and she just captured the raw moment and what was going on. And that's what I love about photography.
Just capturing something that wasn't staged for our
appeal. Yeah. Something that's actual, genuine, and just a moment that two people actually experienced.
You know, part of when I said that this show was refreshing, part of what I mean has to do with exactly what you were saying, that everyone has been a teen, but that you don't necessarily remember everything about what it's like. And there's a lot that I'm very happy to leave behind me about my teen years, but I do remember this very spirited determination to be who you are. And when you talk about things being genuine and unposed, it's a delight to reconnect with that spirit.
Mm-hmm.
I want to introduce now Katie Moore, who is also on the Teen Council at the Kemper. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
What does art mean to you, first of all?
Oh, wow. That's a big question.
It is.
To me, usually art started out as just, you know, a relaxing thing I would do when I was young. And then it started being like, I could find out what I could do with my art. I could make cards for people. And to me, art is like communication in a way, to communicate what you're thinking to other people without using words. Because sometimes a picture is worth 1,000 words, you know, that kind of deal.
So when you decided to be on the Kemper Art Council, what were you looking forward to about having this kind of say in what was happening at a museum in your city?
I didn't really know we would have this much freedom to do what we did in the Teen Arts Council. I thought it was going to be more of just like art really enrichment. I knew we would make some programs, but I had no idea it would be to the level that the Teen Arts Council had. So I was very impressed and just surprised that we could do really whatever we wanted. If we wanted to make flyers, we made out some flyers. We detailed all of our teen programs to the smallest detail. It was amazing.
When you and the other teens on this council ended up with the theme flawless and dealing with sort of stereotypes and beauty and flaw and perfection and all of those kinds of things that, as I recall, do really mean a lot to teenagers in general.
Yeah.
What was it about that theme that appealed to you or that feels like it connected with you?
What the theme really connected to me was, like, now in this day and age, you know, there's a standard for beauty. There's a standard for what perfection is. And a lot of people feel like they don't meet that standard. A lot of people do. And so I hope this exhibit kind of opens up people's eyes. You know, there is not a standard for, like, how valuable you are, how important you are. You are you. And I hope this exhibit, when people see it, it just kind of opens their eyes that you can't put someone down because of who they are, or where they come from, or what they look like.
Can you tell me about the image that you wrote about?
It was natural fashion number 77. It spoke to me because I love learning about different cultures, and this picture was just beautiful when I first saw it, and I said, this needs to be in the exhibit, guys. Come on. So that was chosen to be put in, and I just loved because the person depicted in the photograph, it was, that person was just completely calm and so, what's the word? She's just amazed. Like, what amazed me is that she was being herself in her own culture, and it just looked so peaceful, the photograph that was taken. It was taken completely in the moment, and it was just a beautiful piece that really spoke to me.
The image itself is of a woman from an African culture that she is wearing some of the traditional clothing of her culture. And she's wearing, she's got her face painted and she's got large earrings doing sort of like the body modification earrings. And in your writing, what part of what you seem to appreciate is that she was representing proudly the traditions of her culture.
Oh, yeah. I think today some people are maybe afraid to, you know, talk about their roots, talk about their culture, because a lot of times, you know, there's a lot of discrimination about that. But the person in the picture, she's just being herself and being her culture, and she's not letting anybody tear her down because of that.
The image, there's an image very nearby that has, it's three bridesmaids wearing pink, and they're kind of laughing. And it feels in some ways like, I don't know, that like that image also represents people participating in a very specific culture. And I like that even though this was so much about finding the beauty in your individuality, that there also was this interest in showing people just participating in something. Can you talk about that, Anthony?
So normal stereotypes with a traditional American wedding, you have your bridesmaids and they're all taking photos, but you see these bridesmaids, they're happy and they're not forced to be in that photo. Once again, it's a moment that's caught in the essence of what's going on, this fantastic moment, a wedding. These bridesmaids are supporting their bride and they're just having fun. They're laughing and just playing with each other. And we chose that one again because even though it doesn't necessarily show a stereotype, as soon as you look at it, you see, oh, these bridesmaids are doing their role. They're bridesmaids in a wedding. And sometimes with cultures and stereotypes, you have to fit into certain roles. And that's what we wanted to depict as well.
So the when I think about this whole like fitting in or not fitting in and something like being a bridesmaid and the kinds of pictures that might be more staged of a group participating in an event like that, I also think about in your age group, you are teens growing up with your lives, as at least as us older people imagine it, just totally unfolding on social media through photographs. And a lot of people do imagine that as a very curated, staged version of someone's lived experience, a very posed version of someone's lived experience. What was it like for you, just comparing it to the role of photos and images in your own life, to look into images created by artists in different times and from different places, and to see maybe a different kind of motivation for creating images of people?
Well, for me, I have no social media, so all the photos that I'm taking, they're not displayed for anybody to see. They're for myself. So if I'm taking a photo of my friend because they had on a nice outfit, it's because I want the photo, not because I wanted to take the photo so that somebody could see it and I could get a bunch of likes.
Can you tell me more about not having a social media presence? Because I was careful to say that it's the lives of teens as people in my age group imagine it being totally on social media. But it's refreshing to hear from a teenager who isn't.
On social media, I have no remorse whatsoever. I don't feel like I'm missing out on anything. I don't feel like there's anything that could be gained. Now, social media is something that's used very heavily to advertise on events and things. So I may not get the memo as soon as everybody else who's scrolling in their feed, but I still get the information. I'm still getting the gist of what's going on. So I'm perfect. I'm fine.
So you, when you are dealing with, you know, taking images, taking photos, as you were saying, they're for you. How do you think that makes your experience of appearance and image different from a lot of the people around you?
I feel like it's more personal in the sense that I'm doing this because I want to. I'm not posing in a Supreme shirt so that I can make money off of it when I post it on Instagram. I'm doing it because I simply liked the outfit. I liked how I styled myself. I liked how the photo turned out. If I didn't like it, I can delete it. Simple. And nobody has to know that I posted it and didn't like it, so I then deleted it and get that backlash. So taking photos for myself and of my friends and family, it's great because then I can scroll back and look, oh, I had this amazing time. And there's nothing attached to it. It's simply my photo and nobody can take it away.
Katie, what are your thoughts on this?
I, too, do not have any social media, so all of my pictures, I go on a lot of trips, and so all of my pictures, I take pictures of the places we go on trips, but a lot of the pictures I have from where I go, it's like when I was driving along the road and I see something special to the place I went, like a monument, I take a picture of that, and just special things that are important to me. You know, I didn't stage them. A lot of them are blurry, really. But it's just more calming to me to look at my pictures. And they're my pictures. They explain what happened in my life. And they weren't staged or anything. And usually it was a complete accident. I came across the places of the pictures that are in. And that's just really special to me.
So you're not, you're not interested in the show and tell aspect of it?
Not really. I feel like, Anthony, I don't feel like I'm missing out on anything, really.
How common, I mean, I'm getting a little off topic here, but how common is it for teens to just sort of forego social media?
I think it's common because, one effect, that everyone's doing it, like you said. And then it can be kind of addicting to just go on and then just look at what everyone else is doing and thinking, oh, you know, I gotta do this too. But for me, I just never really had that effect. I just wanted to take pictures for myself and be in the moment.
Do you think that having that kind of relationship with what you look at and what you don't look at, and being sort of your own guide to what's important, also helped you pick out images for this show and see and things, beauty that maybe someone else could miss?
You know, it really did, because looking through all the glazed pictures for the show and the first stages of mapping it out, I was looking through and I tried to think of, like, what's a meaning I could take from this? What's a hidden meaning that people, when they look at this picture, they wouldn't think of this, but it's still there? And that was my challenge, really. And that I also do the same thing with my artwork or with my photographs.
What's something that other people don't see
in the works for the Kemper?
I mean, just that that's kind of your guiding light.
Really, just what's the meaning behind it? So if it's, I take a picture of someone doing something, well, why are they doing it? I really try to think of all the steps it took them to be there, you know, and with my art, I tried to put in a hidden meaning, you know, maybe in the background, what's really happening in that scene.
Is there an image that either of you want to talk about that you didn't write about for the show, but that as you've spent time with the flawless show at the Kemper that the Teen Council put together, that has been really meaningful to you?
So there's this piece, I don't know the name or who made it, but it's a picture of this older woman. She got into art late, and she is embracing her wrinkles. She's embracing her flaws and all that stuff.
This is a painting?
In the exhibition, mm-hmm. Flawless.
Yeah.
We chose this one because...
Is it the one... There's one where there's a woman, like you described, wearing an I Am Loved button?
Yeah, an I Am Loved button, because... Even though, as stereotypes, when you get older, oh, wrinkles are bad, you want flawless skin, she embraced them. She took those wrinkles and then made it into a piece of art that's for herself. And then she has that button in that painting saying, I am loved. Not by any of you guys, and I care if you think I look nice. I'm loved because I love myself. So having that instance of no social media helping with that, we realize there's also stereotypes when you get older and when you're older and you don't have to just worry about it when you're at a teen's age or a young adult, you still have to worry about stereotypes up until you die. So that's something that you have to deal with your whole life.
That gave you an insight into an experience you haven't had yet.
Yeah. And we're nowhere near that age yet.
No.
But you can relate to what people are experiencing.
Yeah.
Katie, any other thoughts from you? Any other works of art you want to give a shout out to before we go?
For me, a powerful artwork was, I think it was called A Portrait of My Mother and Father. And it was two older parents, and they were sharing a meal. It's just, you could see the love that they had for each other and how the stereotype is, you know, love doesn't last. And in that picture, you can see that they've been in love for years and years. And that's just a powerful piece to me.
Well, Katie Moore, Anthony Moses III, thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Flawless is on view at the Kemper through February 17th. And if you or someone you know wants to be on the Teen Council, the Teen Arts Council at the Kemper, applications are open and you can find out more on their website, kemperart.org. And that is a wrap for today's show. You can listen back to anything you heard or missed at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where we keep all of our past shows. And we hope you have a great Arts October. This has been some sort of highlights that we picked out, but it's a busy month, and we're glad that you joined us today. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this show is produced by Melody Rowell with Kathleen Pointer, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and we're going to jog on out. Have a great weekend, everyone. Stick around for Up to Date next.